I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. A Christmas Far From Home, an epic tale of courage and survival during the Korean War is what we talk about this hour of our program today. And our guest is the author of that book. He's been with us before talking about Pearl Harbor during Christmas time and a wonderful book he wrote about the Christmas Truce of 1914. He is a veteran of the Korean War. He received his master's degree in English from Temple University in absentia because he was called to duty in the conflict in Korea 2 months prior to graduation. So he spent time serving in the 8th Army as a first lieutenant. He was awarded the Bronze Star and the Korean Ribbon with 5 battle stars. This is his 6th book about war at Christmas time, and we're going to be talking about the history of this, the bloodiness at this time of year, what happened in Korea. We'll talk about Harry Truman, we'll talk about MacArthur, and we'll talk about the common soldiers and what they had to endure during a bitter, bitter cold time of war, and also being understaffed. Well, welcome phone calls for Stanley. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Our email is talk@WPR.org, and we're also on Twitter, and that's at K Dunn Show. Stanley Weintraub, thank you very much for being with us again. Hello.
You're welcome. Glad to be back.
Yeah, nice to have you here. Tell me about you in the Korean War. How did you happen to enter that war, and where and when did you serve?
I entered the war as a reserve lieutenant. I didn't know when I'd be called in, but it turned out that I was teaching as a teaching assistant working on a master's degree. When I was called in for active duty, I had to give my classes their finals very early. Some of the students actually wrote farewell messages to me on their final papers and hoped I'd come back alive, and I did.
Mm-hmm. And you wrote a memoir in 1954, didn't you, about your time there?
I wrote a memoir about a 6-week period in the Korean War. In 1952, called War in the Words. It was about the mutinies of communist prisoners, the mutinies that had to be turned back with infantry, with tear gas, with flamethrowers, with tanks. It was literally unreported.
Mm-hmm.
The mutinies that were reported were on the prison island of Koji. But the mutinies on the mainland were never reported. No newsmen were allowed. And the reason was that the site was the prisoner of war hospital, the largest hospital in the world at that time.
Mm-hmm.
We had over 10,000 patients.
Woo.
And many of them were absolutely fanatic communists, even though they might have been amputees or otherwise badly wounded. If you can imagine amputees marching on their stumps.
Oh my gosh.
In mutiny, holding homemade communist flags, you'd understand the nature of fanaticism.
Wow. This was called, and you have an interesting piece in the intro to your book, A Police Action. It became known in this country as a police action. It was anything but. It was a war. How did it get that term, a police action? Who gave it that?
President Truman got tarred with that title, but it never was his invention. Senator William Noland of California, conservative Republican senator, called it a police action, defending it. And a reporter asked President Truman in a press conference, do you agree with Senator Noland that this is not a war, it's a police action? And, of course, Truman was very glad to have support. And he said, yes, he did. But it quickly became a full-fledged war. And although it was called a limited war, because he wanted to limit it so it would not turn into a world war. It was a very bloody affair with tens of thousands of dead, tens of thousands of wounded, and fought in terrible circumstances.
Mm-hmm. You begin the book with a meeting between President Truman and Douglas MacArthur on Wake Island on October 15, 1950, with Truman having to go to MacArthur, which says something. What was that meeting about?
President Truman wanted the support of MacArthur politically because MacArthur represented the far-right constituency in the United States and, of course, in Congress. And so he wanted to meet him, who he had never met him, to discuss the war and also to find out something about MacArthur because, after all, the two of them had both served in World War One. They had never met before. They were political rivals. It seemed useful to meet him. MacArthur was very stubborn and said he was much too busy. He couldn't possibly fly to the United States.
Oh, goodness.
Truman. He was not busy at all, I can tell you. but Truman gave in and flew 7,000 miles or so to Wake Island. And MacArthur flew a very short distance from Tokyo to Wake Island. They met briefly. MacArthur was very positive about how the war had been going and said he expected he would be able to send all the troops home except a brief occupation force by the end of the year. And they parted. MacArthur said he had business in Tokyo. He couldn't stay for lunch. And he went off again. He had a very soft time of it, actually, in Tokyo. He went to Korea before the war, only once in his career, and that was very briefly for the inauguration of Syngman Rhee, who he imposed as president on South Korea. And at that point, he bragged to Syngman Rhee, and this was on radio, that if the communists actually threatened South Korea, he would defend South Korea as if it were California. As if it were California. Of course, he had no ability to defend South Korea, nor did he have the authority to defend South Korea. He acted as if he were his own Department of Defense and State Department put together, but he really had no close touch with what was going on. He had a big transport plane. It didn't go anywhere. He never reviewed his troops in the field. Some regiments would march into Tokyo, and he would review them from his headquarters at the Daiichi Building, which was across from the Emperor's Palace. But he never went to maneuvers or to inspect troops or to see how they were doing. His troops were soft occupation troops who really had nothing to do. They were supposed to keep in shape, but they never had to make their beds. They never had to do KP. They seldom had to do anything other than just enjoy themselves. It was a soft life, and he didn't know how soft it was. He also didn't know how poorly prepared they were when the war began and the North Koreans swarmed down into South Korea. His troops were largely in senior officers, troops from World War II, that is, colonels and majors and so on from World War II. The enlisted men were largely draftees and recruits who had come in after World War II with the idea that if they served their time, they could get on the GI Bill and then go to college. So these were not people who were gung-ho military people, eager to fight another war. They had World War II equipment, by the way. They didn't have anything new.
Who made, when Truman and MacArthur back to that meeting on Wake Island, did Truman question MacArthur about what his plans were, what the war strategy was to have this all over by Christmas?
No, he didn't, because MacArthur was such an overwhelming icon
really?
In the country. The senior general in the Army, the only five-star general on active duty, he was untouchable. MacArthur, one of his senior officers, said in Tokyo, MacArthur was God. And they really believed that he was larger than life. He made up his own fantasy routine. He would go in style from the ambassador's house that he had taken over in Tokyo to the Daiichi building. He would be there for the morning. He had no telephone in his office. People had to bring messages to him. He sat there and took notes, looked out over the emperor's palace across the street, imagined himself as the pseudo-emperor. I've been there, by the way. I've been in his office.
Oh.
And I was taken there by a Japanese publisher who published some of my books. I went to the Daiichi in a big limousine. We went up to the top floor. And in front of MacArthur's office, which is kept as a shrine, although it is still a private insurance company, was a bronze plaque that said, this is the office used by General MacArthur when he was occupation commander of Japan. General MacArthur saved Japan. And they really meant that he saved Japan. He prevented the emperor from being tried as a war criminal. And basically, he let the Japanese do domestically whatever they wanted to do. And he had little to do about it. He went home for an afternoon nap. He then came back in style and worked for a while. But he almost never left Tokyo and didn't know what was going on around him, which is why it was a great shock when suddenly he got a telephone call that the North Koreans had invaded the South, and that President Truman wanted him to send troops to try to keep the North Koreans from taking over the South Korean Republic. He sent troops who were not ready to fight. He sent troops that had weapons that were not useful. For example, their rocket launchers, bazookas, were World War II instruments that bounced off the Soviet-made tanks.
Oh, goodness.
And the troops ran away. They were terrified. That was a very bad scene. Much of the North Korean army marched through the south. They took over the capital, Seoul. They left only a small sliver of land known as the Pusan Perimeter because the port of Pusan was kept in American hands. It took a while before, thanks to the Marines, MacArthur was able to establish a flanking movement by sea that surrounded the North Koreans and took Seoul back. And it looked like the war was over. He had rescued South Korea. But that wasn't enough for him. He wanted to take over all of Korea. After all, he said that there's nothing like victory. War requires victory. Truman wanted a limited war. He wanted the war kept to the rescue of South Korea.
So
he did not want World War III.
Yeah. So MacArthur disobeyed him.
But MacArthur, of course, disobeyed everything. He went into North Korea. He was told by the Pentagon, "Don't send American troops too far into North Korea because the Chinese will not like that and they'll intervene." And the communist Chinese who had taken over the mainland of China didn't have a great deal of modern equipment, although they had some supplied by the Russians. But they had a lot of equipment that we had given them by way of giving them to Chiang Kai-shek's army. Chiang Kai-shek's army had fled. And they had our guns, they had our ammunition, they had all of our equipment, billions of dollars worth of it that we had given the nationalist Chinese. And with that, they infiltrated into North Korea. He promised that Truman that this wouldn't happen, that the Chinese would be afraid of us. I mean, after all, we had the atomic bomb. But the the Chinese told the ambassador to China from India, who was a sympathizer of theirs, Truman can drop all the atomic bombs he wants. There are no targets in China for atomic bombs.
Mm-hmm.
And the pre-industrialized China, of course, didn't have any targets for those bombs. And although MacArthur's intelligence chief, General Willoughby, who was a toady, told MacArthur only what he wanted to hear, which was that the Chinese wouldn't intervene, they were busy intervening quite surreptitiously because the weather was bad, it was snowing. They crossed the Yalu not only when it froze over and was iced, but even before that, they built surreptitiously wooden bridges about a foot under the water that couldn't be seen from the air, and crossed over that way at night and then hid in North Korea during the day. We didn't see them at all. MacArthur, nevertheless, intended on an offensive that was going to take over all of North Korea. The day after Thanksgiving, which was already very cold, so cold that the Thanksgiving dinners flown over from Japan literally froze before the troops could get them to their mouths.
Mm.
And they called them turkey popsicles.
Oh, goodness.
It was that cold. The wind and the cold that was getting toward 20 below zero was called the Siberian Express. But MacArthur came over briefly in his transport plane the day after Christmas. He announced the offensive was going to begin the next day. You never begin an offensive by announcing it to the enemy, but he did. And then he decided to fly over North Korea to see whether the Chinese really had come down. And flying in his transport plane 9,000 feet up in the snow, he, of course, saw nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And any of your listeners who have been in an airplane know that when you're up at 9 or 10,000 feet or even higher, you don't see a person. It's not possible.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, he did not see anybody. He flew back to Japan. General Stratemeyer, the Air Force general, who was a toady again of MacArthur's, awarded him a Distinguished Flying Cross.
Oh, my.
It was a medal he didn't have.
Yeah.
And that was probably the only reason he received it.
What do you make of the idea, and I'm wondering how far MacArthur would have had to stay back, that MacArthur ordered everybody too far north, and that's why the Chinese conducted their assault against the troops. Do you think there's any way to read the mind of Mao in this? Was he planning this all along to secure his own power? Or if
Mao had written on military strategy, and I quote in translation in my book about what he had written. MacArthur must have known what he had written because it was widely published. Mao had been on the military scene rebelling against Chiang Kai-shek for 20 years. He had lots of military expertise. What he had said very bluntly was, if you don't have the strength of your enemy in firepower, lure the enemy into a trap. Lure the enemy into a trap. Let them advance until they think that they're winning the war, and then surround them and eliminate them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's exactly what he intended to do, and what he almost succeeded in doing.
We need to pause for a moment. We'll return. Stanley Weintraub is our guest this hour. His latest book is A Christmas Far From Home, an epic tale of courage and survival during the Korean War. Stanley has written a number of historical books and a number of books about Christmas time, war in Christmas time, World War One, World War Two, Revolutionary War, and others. And he happens to be a vet of the Korean War. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter, and that's @KDunnShow. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, we welcome phone calls. Those of you who have served in the Korean War, we're particularly interested in hearing from you, survivors of that war, who can describe maybe the various things that Stanley is talking about and writing about. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, email talk at WPR.org. Our Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show. Leave your messages there. Stanley Weintraub, I'm just wondering, you as a young man who was called to service in the Korean War, what did you think you would encounter? I mean, I don't know how you steel yourselves for the great unknown.
When I arrived in Korea, it was just after General MacArthur had been fired by Truman for insubordination. I knew the war was far from over. And when my shipload arrived in Japan on the way to Korea, we were transferred to a rusty old Japanese ferry that took us to Korea, and then we were reassigned to various locations. We didn't know where we would be going. And I think our worry was not so much getting killed, because it's all over when you're killed. Our worry was getting maimed. And this was a serious matter, because you can be maimed no matter where you happen to be.
Mm-hmm.
The shells don't pick you out by name.
Mm-hmm.
And the Koreans, North Koreans and the Chinese, did not have long-range artillery, but they had mortars, and they had machine guns, and they had grenades, which they called potato mashers, because they had wooden handles that from which they threw their grenades, and they did that from hiding. You never knew where they were because they were such expert infiltrators, and they wore uniforms that had white on one side and ground color, a mustard color, on the other side. So in snow, they wore the white out, and they were hardly visible. They were a very dangerous group, and they were highly numerous. They knew how to get around and surround you.
Mm-hmm.
And troops had to worry about running out of ammunition because there were so many Chinese. At one point, the Marines, the elite force in the eastern sector, who had gone up as far as the Chosun Reservoir, which had frozen over, ran out of 16-millimeter ammunition.
Oh, my.
And they radioed to Japan desperately. They needed more shells for their mortars. And things were so incompetently run that when they radioed in code for mortar shells, they radioed for Tootsie Rolls, which is what the code was. And guess what they got? They
got Tootsie Rolls. Oh.
Yeah. Which, of course, meant that they couldn't possibly continue resisting where they were, and they had to retreat. They didn't call it a retreat. They called it advancing in another direction, because the Chinese had surrounded them, and any direction you went, you had to shoot your way. And it became a terrible situation in the bitter cold and in the snow and in the infiltration of Chinese all around. I think one of the most dramatic pages I ever wrote, or I ever would write, was about the experience of crossing perhaps the only airdrop bridge in war, a feat that I think strikes amazement even in retelling. Marine General Oliver Smith worried, as he had pushed north, that there was a one-lane concrete bridge that crossed a 4,000-foot-high chasm, the Funchalin Pass. And he worried crossing it was not difficult, even though it was windy and cold. But it was narrow, and it was the only bridge there. And if the Chinese infiltrated to the south and blew it up, how would they get back? And he worried about getting back because he knew that MacArthur was totally in fantasy about taking over North Korea.
Mm.
The Funchalen Pass, thousands of feet below, had water from the Chosun Reservoir surging toward a power plant. When the Marines were heading back, the Chinese blew the span. The Marines had to withdraw under fire, but they had to cross the gorge. And a Marine engineer told General Smith, I'll get you a bridge. And he ordered by radio to an air base in Japan, treadway steel bridge sections, each one weighed over a ton, to be dropped and deployed. And they were dropped from 800 feet under fire from the Chinese. These were parachuted down, and most of the eight that were dropped actually were saved. A few of them broke in being dropped, and in whirling gusts and below zero squalls, the chasm had to be closed by Marine engineers. And this is 4,000 feet up in the dark, under fire, and 20 below zero, the wind's blowing. Somehow, they managed to bridge the gap, and it's a tremendous feat, and a harrowing feat besides. To bolster the gap, because they had run out of span space, required what the engineers called dead men. And the soldiers thought that quite literally, as they began crossing, they were crossing on the frozen bodies of dead men. They were not. They were bridging timbers, and engineers called these timbers dead men. But the troops overhearing them were not frightened by it, but appalled. They had to cross. There was no choice. And trucks and tanks carrying the living and the dead proceeded hazardously at about 2 miles an hour across this narrow span that they had created. It was not only narrow, but it was icy because of the swirling wind and the snow falling down. As far as I know, only one truck slipped off. It was carrying both the living and the dead. And it slipped off, falling rear first, 4,000 feet down, the bodies falling out of the truck. And troops saw this and, of course, were appalled by it, but they had to keep moving. The headlights stared up at them as they crossed in the dark. And the men looked like a walking arsenal. According to a reporter, they had grenades strung across their chests and across their arms. And someone in the column remarked that they looked like a walking army of Christmas trees. Like Christmas balls on trees. But this Christmas was approaching, and of course they were thinking of Christmas. They knew they could never be home for Christmas, as MacArthur had promised. They didn't even know if they'd be alive by Christmas. But they were heading toward the shore, the Japan Sea, where 93 ships had been gathered to take them aboard, and they had to fight their way down beyond the bridge and down to the sea. And at Hungnam Harbor, they crawled up the gangways to the ships and were able to, those who survived were able to go back to South Korea. They tried to take back all the dead they could because Marines in particular don't want to leave their
behind.
But they couldn't take them all back. They had to have a funeral ceremony on the beach. And to actually make graves possible, they had to use explosives to break the soil up.
Let's welcome phone calls for you, Stanley. Stanley Weintraub is our guest. His book is A Christmas Far From Home, an epic tale of courage and survival during the Korean War. 800-486-8655 is our number, and Brian is calling on the road. Hi, Brian.
Hey, how are you this afternoon?
Fine. How are you?
Oh, just great. Hey, this really is something that touched me. I was friends with a number of veterans quite older than I was at the Korean War. And I had one friend of mine that left a Chosun Reservoir with several boxes of .45 ammo and one pistol. And he and about eight or nine other guys went were separated from everybody else and got themselves back home, or got themselves to the pickup point where they contacted other people to get them out of there. But it was a long, long hike and a cold, nasty nights. And another friend of mine ended up grabbing a sack full of Spam, and for the rest of his life, he never would touch it or even look at it in a grocery store. It was just this is a testament to the complete hubris of U.S. after World War II, where suddenly at the end of the war, it was a combination of disgust, I suppose, and arrogance that made
there was so much command competence.
It just is amazing to me how the story of fighting the last war always seems to be the rule of the wars that currently are in place. Thank you very much for your effort on this book. It's appreciated by many.
Thank you, Brian. Stanley?
One of the problems is that incompetence gets rewarded. And I hate to say that, but it's really true. Incompetence gets rewarded. A general, for example, might have screwed up, and in order to get him out of there and put in somebody else, you reward him by giving him a promotion and you send him elsewhere.
Right.
And the most extreme example I know of this is that General MacArthur's toady, General Almond, who commanded the 10th Corps, which was the command over the Marines and other Army divisions, when he left Korea, had a third star. He was promoted to lieutenant general and became commandant of the Army War College. This is what happens.
Yeah. Stanley, what was the reason, what was the ostensible reason for Americans' involvement in Korea?
Americans were the only forces available to try to head off the total absorption of South Korea by the communists. They were the occupation army in Japan and the closest to Korea. It was assumed that they were in combat readiness, that they were trained regularly, that they did maneuvers, that they knew what they were doing, that they were well-equipped, but the oversight was very poor. And that wasn't the case. An occupation army generally has a good time of it, and they did. And General Almond represented the worst, probably, of the occupation army. When he took command in Northeast Korea, he flew over in a big transport that contained trailers that were house trailers for him. He had a bed to sleep in. He had a kitchen. He had a well-stocked bar. He actually threw dinner parties while his troops starved in the far north. We don't really read about that, but
no,
it does
we don't.
Happen. And one of my late friends, who just died early this year, was a major on Almond's staff, and said that the troops were appalled by this kind of behavior. In other words, two standards, one for them and one for us.
Yeah.
But living by MacArthur's style in Tokyo and doing it in North Korea.
Here's a Facebook message, Rich writing, I write to honor my cousin, Val Eugene, who fought in Korea. I recall my sister writing to him every single day that he lived. He reportedly handed her letters out to his buddies because at mail call he was overwhelmed by her letters and many of his buddies didn't receive any mail during their tours. He goes on, I also write to honor myself. I refused to serve in Vietnam and was assigned alternative service by my draft board in Oneida County. I write to honor my Uncle Bob, who took me aside during the 60s and said, do whatever you have to in order to avoid the military. They'll tell you you have to serve. They're full of blank. I saw war. I know what it does to people. I'll back you up even if everyone in the family disowns you. And I listen to him.
Speaking of letters, I think one of the most poignant I talk about in the book is that of a Navy doctor from Philadelphia was in that march from the Chosin Reservoir south, he actually said he marched while sleeping, that he hardly knew what he was doing because he was so frozen. When he got to a camp where there was rehabilitation and where he was asked to help with the wounded soldiers, he did so and offered one soldier who was so badly wounded that he was being flown back to Japan a letter to his parents, telling them, as many soldiers often do, "It's everything's fine out here. I'm well."
Yes, right.
And he wrote such a letter to his parents and gave it to the soldier to send back. What he didn't realize is that the soldier's blood, which had coagulated in the cold, began to bleed again on his trip back to Japan. And the letter that he mailed from Japan to his parents had the soldier's blood all over the envelope.
Oh, no.
And when the parents, of course, fainted when they got the letter.
Oh, Stanley, it's such a horrible story. We're going to welcome more phone calls. And here's how you can join our conversation. Stanley Weintraub is our guest. His latest book is A Christmas Far From Home, an epic tale of courage and survival during the Korean War. He's joined us before to talk about the Christmas truce, World War I, which is quite a story. And he's written about Pearl Harbor Christmas as well. Here's how you join us. 800-486-8655. Is the number, 800-486-8655. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Stanley Weintraub, our guest this hour, 800-486-8655 is the number for you to call. So many who have served in war talk about this need to stay alive, which certainly sounds like it was true in Korea, and also this need to take care of the people who are around you, that becomes your guiding light, your guiding force, the reason that you're there. Is that fair to say?
It's not a matter of waving the flag and patriotism. It's loyalty to those next to you, your buddies. You want to take care of them.
Yeah. Let's go to Maddie in Waupaca. Hi, Maddie. Maddie, are you there?
Yes.
Yes, go ahead, please.
Okay. Yes, my brother Vernon W. Cornelius was born and raised on the Oneida Indian Reservation here in Wisconsin, and he was there, and he was in the 1st Marine Division. And I was very young when he died. Was killed in a train accident. This is, he was turning 26 after he came back home. But anyway, people tell me that sometimes he would wake up in the middle of the night and jump out of bed and say, "The Reds are coming, the Reds are coming," because the Chinese would like to attack when they were trying to sleep. Could he comment about that? Thank you.
The Chinese would always attack at night. Because they wanted the element of surprise, and it didn't make any difference what time of the day or night it was for them. They also didn't have the equipment we had, like walkie-talkie radios. They signaled each other by using a trumpet, for example, or by using flares, and using noises and bright lights were terrifying when suddenly you come upon them in the middle of the night and you're in a tent sleeping. The Chinese were good at this, and what they would do would be to sneak up on a tent and throw grenades in, and you were obviously helpless to do anything about it. The problem of infiltration was very great. They would slip in all around the troops that were trying to sleep or that were trying to protect other troops. And there was nothing one could do except fire until you ran out of ammunition. Mm. And if you ran out of ammunition, you were finished. The Chinese would take your guns, would steal your boots, would take your parkas, and leave the wounded to die in 20 below zero weather.
Mm.
They didn't have the equipment of their own. They wanted other equipment that was better than theirs, and it was important for them to rob us to get what they needed. It was very easy on the other coast, on the west coast, where the 8th Army was running away from the Chinese. They were so terrified by the Chinese. These were not as professional troops as the Marines. They abandoned their tanks, their trucks. They literally even abandoned their boots so they could run faster.
Hmm.
And, of course, that was a devastatingly stupid thing to do. But the Chinese wanted those boots.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Maddie, for the call. Let's go to Ray in Madison. Hi, Ray.
Hi.
Hi.
I just happened to be doing something when my wife was baking, and she had your station on.
Mm-hmm.
And everything that you were talking about, I experienced by being there.
Mm-hmm.
I landed at Incheon, which I thought was very good for MacArthur. And we worked our way up to the Yellow River when MacArthur said the Chinese would not come in.
Mm-hmm.
But they did come in, and we of about, we probably had 12,000 Marines there at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I was a sergeant, so I don't keep track of those numbers and things. But I was up there, and there was Udamni, there was Hegaru, and there was one other one. And we were split out in those three different areas and fought our way back to an area where we were once again together, and then fought our way back to Hamnung, where there were ships waiting for us. And we
did you cross over the Silin Pass in that temporary?
Came back to South Korea, and we reorganized there. And at that spot, I left Baker Company, which I was not real pleased with because it was made up of about 85%, maybe 80%, of reserves who I did not know. Because of the beginning of the entire activity, we were low in numbers wherever we were and brought in a lot of reserves and this and used a small amount of regulars, of which I was one, to fill in the void. And so when I got back to South Korea after the Chosin Reservoir and reorganized, then I went into Dog Company, D Company,
mm-hmm.
and I went there because I had friends and somewhat knew the company commander, and that's where I finished up my Korean activity. But all of what they were talking about, I was there
mm-hmm.
when we crossed the 38th parallel mm-hmm. initially
mm-hmm.
and had to come back.
Mm-hmm.
So that MacArthur could make a scene mm. of cutting the ribbon, crossing yeah. the 30. I saw that. And we had a general at that time by the name of Chesty Puller. And I can remember smiling because after the ceremony of cutting the ribbon, MacArthur went to pin a medal on Chesty Puller. And Chesty Puller took the medal, turned his back to MacArthur, and said, "Well, I got work to do. I got to go."
Oh, my gosh.
Don't do that, MacArthur.
No. Thank you, Ray, very much for your reminiscences. I'm glad your wife was listening to the radio. It's hard to imagine something being as poorly managed as this was. MacArthur was just didn't know what he was doing, Stanley.
MacArthur would fly in for an hour or two at some safe place, and asked to have some soldiers or Marines brought to him so he could pin medals on them.
Oh.
And many had great contempt for this.
Right.
And One who didn't get a medal, by the way, was General Smith, who was the brilliant commander of the Marine Division.
Mm-hmm.
But MacArthur and his deputy, General Arnold, carried pockets full of medals with them. And it didn't make any difference as to who they gave them to. The person who stood with them as an aide was the future General Haig. General Haig, who was then a captain. He had a notebook with him, and he'd write down the name of the soldier who got a medal, and he would then write up a citation that had nothing to do with the soldier's background.
Thank you, Ray, so much for your call, and thanks for your service. Sounds like it was not very easy. Carl in Madison is next. Hi, Carl.
Howdy. I hope you can hear me.
Yes.
You're kind of faint.
We can hear.
I suppose I'm kind of typical. I don't know much about the last couple of years of the Korean War. I lived through it, but I was only 10 years old. Can you briefly tell me, after MacArthur was dismissed, was his mismanagement corrected fairly quickly or at all? And in fact, General Eisenhower became President Eisenhower, and how did he react to the mismanagement? Did he straighten it out?
General MacArthur was dismissed in April 1951, and General Ridgway, Matthew Ridgway, took over. He was a fighting general who stayed up with his troops and knew what he was doing, kept everybody on alert. He was an ex-paratrooper from World War II, and he would wear on his paratroop harness a grenade on one side and a first aid kit on the other, and he was known as Old Iron Tits because of it. The troops loved him. He didn't have that godlike background that MacArthur had.
Mm-hmm.
When MacArthur returned to the United States, he spoke to Congress, I think, the day after he landed and delivered mesmerizingly his farewell to military service, quoting a line from an old soldier ballad, "Old soldiers never die, they just fade away." But he had no intentions of fading away, and he tried to interfere in the conduct of the war. He tried to campaign on his own for president. He and Eisenhower, who disliked each other, both were interested in becoming president, and Eisenhower said that he would end the war. He would end the war, and he would end the war on his terms, and the enemy would have to give in. The terms that he ended the war on were actually President Truman's terms, but Truman had run out of his time in office, and Eisenhower came over to Korea spoke with the generals in command and said, "We have to end the war at the 38th parallel," which is where it began. And basically, that's where the war ended. And we still have a truce roughly on the 38th parallel.
Yeah, we sure do. Thank you very much, Carl, for your call. And that's all the time we have. I'm sorry. There's much more to talk about. But, Stanley, thank you. That's why people should go to the book. Thank you very much for being with us this hour.
You're welcome. Glad to be with you again.
Stanley Weintraub, the book is A Christmas Far From Home, an epic tale of courage and survival during the Korean War. And he served in the Korean War as well. He was in school at Temple University, called to duty in the conflict 2 months before he graduated, and spent time in the 8th Army as a first lieutenant, awarded the Bronze Star and also the Korean Ribbon with 5 battle stars. He's written a great book about the Christmas Truce, World War I, 1914, which is a great great story as well, worth sharing at this Christmas time. Thank you very much to Scotty Myers for producing this hour, and thanks to K.P. Whaley for production work and on-air work here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. And thank you, everybody, for your calls. Great conversations ahead. We're with you again tomorrow from 1 until 3. So join us for those conversations. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.